and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Episode 18, Primary Teachers and Physical Literacy with Dr. Fiona Heath-Diffie.
Welcome back to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, and we are with a special guest in the podcast studio, and I have the pleasure actually of introducing them as Dr. Fiona Heath-Diffie. How are you doing?
Thank you.
Congratulations, newly doctored Fiona.
Yes.
And this is a returning visit. You featured twice on the podcast so far, way back in the ether in our first season when you came in to talk to us about physical literacy, which is something that you're going to return to and give us a refresher on today. But you're here to talk to us about your doctorate. You're sort of still in the last phase, aren't you? You're making your final corrections.
Yes, final amendments at the moment.
But essentially, we can start calling you Doctor now, can't we?
Dr. Hopefully by the time this goes out, yes.
Yeah, okay. Well,
it's definitely time to get someone back in when the room where you recorded their first appearance no longer exists.
That's a very good point. It doesn't. That's very true.
No, so you're back in our studio now. Very pleased.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, have you here. So in a sort of tiny, quick sort of thing, just to kind of frame this whole thing, what is your doctorate about? I know that's the worst question that everyone always asks people who've done doctorates, but like, what is it in a few sentences?
So I was interested in tracking the physical literacy journey of primary PGC students in their in the journey of them becoming PE teachers. So obviously they're training to do multiple subject areas, but specifically in the element of physical education, what does that journey look like for them, and how does that inform the values and beliefs and the pedagogy they go on to pick and choose from and sort of construct their lessons from when they are training and then into the big bad world of teaching. So in a nutshell, that's what I was interested in looking at.
And it's really important, I think, that we come back to that concept of physical literacy. So perhaps again, you know, if those listeners out there who are not familiar with that term, perhaps you could give us a summary of what that's all about.
Absolutely. So the concept developed by Professor Margaret Whitehead initially and as in more recent years has sort of been expanded upon. But in essence, it's a philosophical concept that looks at this idea that we are through three pillars of philosophy, that we, when we look at ourselves, be it that me as myself or the parent to the child or the teacher to the child or the person growing from sort of birth to death and across that what we call the lifespan, that we are made up of, there are three pillars that make up the concept. There's this pillar of monism, which sort of says that we are a holistic person. We need to look at our mind and our body as one whole thing. We shouldn't separate it out. For teaching, we shouldn't separate out and just teach the body. We need to consider the mind as well. And then it's underpinned by this concept of existentialism, which says we are made of our own experiences. So we are who we are because of the experiences that we have. And each experience builds on the next, and we learn from those experiences. So that fundamentally roots in existentialism. And then the third pillar is phenomenology. And from the perspective of a phenomenologist, is this idea that we review our world through our own unique lens. So each of us might have the same experience in the same moment, but our perception of what that experience is and how we what we take from it will be different because of the way we read that experience, but that reading of that experience is informed by the previous experiences that we have had. So the concept of physical literacy talks about this idea of how do we create lifelong enjoyment and physical activity from all the different life phases that we go through, and how does that change and morph so we maintain a physically active lifestyle, but from a place of embodied intent. So we do it from an internalized place, not because It's I have to keep fit and I have to lose weight and I have to do this and I have to do that. It comes from this really internalized, that the Holy Grail is it is an embodied experience with this idea of human flourishing, and that we are the best versions of ourselves. And what that means for me might be different to you, Tom, and might be different to you, Emma. So we are all on our unique journeys. Mm. So that in essence is the concept. It's then sort of underpinned by this idea that taking those sort of three philosophical pillars into consideration, that there are different factors that then affect our journeys that we're on. And they centre around things like motivation, confidence, the physical skills, having the right skills at the right time, developing the right skills at the right time, being motivated and confident to want to use them, and being able to then read and interpret the environment around us in how we're using them and responding to the different environments that we're in. So that we value and take responsibility for. So it's then two really big concepts that under the concept that if you are motivated and confident and you have the right skills, you will then value why you want to be active, and you will then take responsibility for that value by informing the decisions you go on to make. And that should then, in theory, when all those things come together, foster this lifelong desire to be physically active in whatever form that takes.
And this is where, when I broaden this out a bit now and I start sort of bringing this to land, thinking about people's own experiences, this is where we start to talk about the kind of value sets that underpin how you teach things. And I was just reflecting there as you were talking about how fun it is that we've got three subject specialists in here who come from subjects that are notorious for you either love them or you hate them. Mm-hmm. You know, some people are really, really into them. Some people would really rather be anywhere else. And I know we've got a bit of a plan to do some work together, haven't we, Fee? Because we think our subjects are very similar, because not only do we have that you love it or you hate it thing, but maybe more than drama, I don't know, Emma might disagree with me here, but there's an elitism that can run through anything to do with sort of PE, physical activity, sport, and music, where there have been teachers who have been there because their values are they want to have the elite sports team or the elite orchestra or the elite choir. And that has a really sort of bad, I'm going to say, flip side on sometimes on those people that are not the elite if you're not very careful about it. And you've got really strong opinions about who should be, you know, or what the value set should be that underpins the teaching of physical kind of activity.
I think definitely, because you really have to ask yourself that it's called PE, so it's the physical education, the education through the physical. It's not called sport. And there's been years and years of research. Professor David Kirk and numerous other people have talked about this, that this is, it's not just sports for sport's sake, whereas PE traditionally has been built on this very Victorian model of doing what was competition, team-based activities, very much driven by the sort of performance calendar of sporting teams outside of a school context. And historically, if you go further back than that, PE was created to increase the fitness levels of the children so they could go and fight, initially in the Boer War and then in the First World War. So actually PE itself, or the journey of PE as a subject, has been rooted very deeply in history. But we now really have this quite much broader sort of challenge and thinking to that, what is the role of that PE teacher when they're in the classroom? So I don't disagree there are children that are going to be really good in your subject area, and to provide them opportunities where they can sing on stage and they can perform in the drama show, and that is their showcase to their strengths, is incredibly important. And at primary level, being able to introduce the children to all those realms of possibility are incredibly important. But what you do in your classroom time and how you do that shouldn't turn off the masses. So historically, primary PE has been taught not particularly well, because a lot of training is lacking in a sense of the time that's given to the subject, and it's a regurgitation of secondary experiences, sometimes delivered by experts, sometimes not. And secondary experiences are very much driven around sort of traditionally this sort of elitist, you're either really good and you're in that class or you're not, and you're kind of just over here just kicking a ball, being active. And of course, there's good practice that challenges that. But there is that sort of bigger idea of what is our value, what we actually want that core message to be. And that's where this concept of physical literacy really, for me, underpins and sort of embeds into this idea that if you want your children, that once they finish teaching them primary or secondary, to be fostering a really positive experience, how I deliver that P, the pedagogy I pick is critical. The language I use around that is critical. How I differentiate those experiences are really, really critical. But as a student teacher, if I've come from a place that has been a really negative experience or a really coached-based experience, it might be positive, but very often the positive experiences are from those who've been heavily involved in coaching and being coached and performing. So they come with sort of an elitist experience, but really excited about doing PE and sort of replicating that experience from a really positive place. Or you get the group that are terrified because they have only ever experienced poor teaching. Maybe it was good at primary, but when they got to secondary, because they weren't in this group of being really good, they were seen to be sort of lacking. So they then were in the second set and they didn't have the access to all the other things. Or they've always wanted to play in the netball team, but they get to the high school and now they're not the best 10. So by default, they don't get into the team and then they stop playing. So you get all those kind of scenarios playing out. So, it really comes from this idea of actually going, what do we need that good practice to look like? And that is where this concept really, for me, comes to fruition. It's where it's so, it really allows us to kind of look at holistically, I'm teaching the right skill at the right time, so my physical competence, what is that and how do I deliver that? But also, how do I develop motivation in my pupils? And what does confidence look like? And how do I develop that so they develop this value and responsibility? But going back to that point, if me as myself as the student teacher does not value, or does value, but has had such negative experiences that they're not confident in that space, don't feel they have the right physical skills to go and teach, haven't been exposed to, so just don't know what it looks like, and can only draw on negative experiences of memories of their PE lessons to know that wasn't right, but how do I do it differently when it's my class, then that becomes a really, really challenging space. So some of the early questions to the research were that there is a gap in the literature from a physical literacy perspective. It doesn't talk about student teachers' journeys, student teachers, sort of the part that they play in this process. It talks about teachers need to create environments where they can do this for their pupils. But actually, what about the student teacher who's coming into that process? And from a teacher training perspective, a direct question for me was actually, I have limited time with them. I can't change that. It's nowhere near the amount of hours I would like it to be from a primary PE perspective. But what do I do with those hours? Where is the hours best place in usage? Because historically, when I took over the running of the PE, it was all content driven. And we was just, it was a little experience in doing creative activities, a little experience in competitive, a little experience in health and well-being and adventurous. And those were the four categories of the curriculum, sort of pre-curriculum reform that we were working to. So we, by default, were delivering a little bit of an experience in all of those four, thinking that that would help the students. But the more I was reading into the concept that and physical literacy itself, the more I was really questioning, well, actually, where is the best placement of time? If they're not confident and they're scared and they're telling us we're scared, do we need to spend a little bit more time breaking down that? So that's kind of where the PhD was born from, this idea of actually, well, what is the journey of that student teacher? What does it look like? And which factors have the most effect when they're out on PGC and NQT year to change and inform the identity they have around themselves physically?
And there could be a temptation right now to talk about this in the contemporary context here in Wales with Curriculum for Wales in mind. However, your data gathering sort of predated Curriculum for Wales. It was sort of around successful features.
It was, yeah. So absolutely. It was sort of 2016-18.
So it's probably important just in the first instance for listeners to know that that was the case. Mm-hmm. Because I think later in the episode, I would like to ask some questions about what you think about Curriculum for Wales,
yeah.
And, you know, both primary and secondary health and wellbeing teachers working in that space. However, I think it's more important that we go back to that time. So you knew about the concept, you knew what you wanted to find out, you knew about the gap. So how did you decide to go about investigating this?
So I basically, with obviously in conversation with my supervisor team, we looked at actually how do we access the primary PGC students, because I'm teaching all of them. So obviously there's a big consideration there for sort of power dynamics and the fact that I'm researching my own students. Mm-hmm. But the reality was that I don't have any influence on their assessments. I just provide the content of those sessions. So actually we felt it was more than okay to research my own students, because obviously there's a direct impact on me as the teacher and then actually what I'm putting into that curriculum program for them. And then I really opened it up to the students and I did a baseline questionnaire and said, this is what I'm interested in. This is, what are your initial thoughts in this? Mm. And who would like to be part of this study? And I had, I think it was about 15 that came back and said, we're interested, could we find out more? And from that, 4 eventually became consistently part of the research group, and they actually stayed with me for the whole 2 years. I didn't lose anybody, which was really nice.
And you followed them over a significant period of time, really. You followed them from PGCE to newly qualified teaching, their sort of early career teaching years.
Yes, so I followed them. So the data collection lasted 2 years. It consisted of 3 interviews in the first year, aligned to the sort of winter, spring, summer terms. So, and then the second year again in their NQT year, I went out to their schools and wherever they were working, or they came into the university. And again, we had 3 interviews that roughly sort of went sort of winter, sort of autumn, winter term, spring, and then summer term.
And what sort of things were you asking them to try and find out about these experiences?
I mean, the early interviews were very much about them and their experiences. So there's an initial baseline interview that kind of almost narrated their backstory. And it was written up as a narrated kind of chapter where it kind of they just talked about what they remember as a child, what their experiences were like, where they were because of how they'd started the PGC, what their thought processes were around PE, what they valued, what they wanted their PE to look like, or what they were scared of, excited about. So it was sort of a baseline starting point.
And is that the existentialism phenomenology sort of theory?
Yeah, that, exactly. It's that idea that to get them to unpick where they're going, there has to be some recognition as what has happened, because we are made of those experiences, and getting them to reflect on those experiences and sort of start to see actually they have impact and they have value, and some are positive and some are negative, but that is a really important starting point. So I sort of, the theory suggests that's an important starting point. So we started there, and then from there, each interview just followed the next. I asked them to keep, it didn't actually materialise particularly well because of the impact of time and things like that. So we reflect on the fact that actually wasn't very successful from a data collection perspective. But I did ask them to sort of bring reflections and notes between the gaps. And then they were getting copies of their transcripts to reflect back on and things like that, because their journeys were all so different. Mm-hmm. So while I had a set of questions that sort of roughly were the same for each of the 4 participants, the reality was those questions went off in very different directions depending on the experiences they'd had, how much PE they were teaching, what their mentor was like, what their school was like, and the impact of those factors, which were not in my control. The reality was I was simply talking to them about what they were doing and thinking, and getting them to reflect on, well, actually, where is your motivation? What's changing it? What you've said that's sort of impacted you positively. Why has that impacted you positively? What was that experience of gym like? What impact has that had in your lessons that have come since then? So it was sort of those kind of questions geared around that underpinning philosophical concept of the motivation, the confidence and the skill set, and how they saw those things developing and changing on in essence, their journey. I also asked them to bring in images. So every time we interviewed them, I asked them to bring in an image or images that reflected where they felt they were in their journey, where they felt they were in their confidence and motivation and their feelings towards teaching PE. So we also spent some time talking around around the images that they were bringing in.
And this really makes me think about the difference between secondary and primary. It makes me think about something we talked about in a recent episode, me and Emma, about some research we'd done. And in it, we set the scene about teaching and said, you know, teaching and learning to be a teacher can be a really emotional process. We sort of know that in secondary, people are tending to be coming from a position of strength subject-wise. You know, they tend to teach the thing they've got a degree in. Can be a weakness, as you said, because they can forget that not everybody comes from that position of strength. But primary, I mean, David Egan was talking in a recent episode about the fact that actually there's loads of great stuff about primary. We know there's loads of great stuff about primary. You teach the same pupils, you really get to, you know, teach them and help them learn in a really holistic way. But then you think about the teachers themselves, and they're having to teach pretty much everything. Mm-hmm. And this was brought home to me when I taught some primary people a couple of years ago, that they're being asked to teach things that maybe they haven't done for a very, very long time. But drawing on what you said earlier on, something they might have had a terrible experience of in their own life, maybe in their own schooling, you know, and that will have had a real effect on what they think about teaching it. So I was just sort of curious while you were talking there and saying about all the things you did with those student teachers. As someone who loves the subject yourself, obviously, because you've taught it and now you teach people how to teach it, you must have heard some things that must have really sort of, I don't know, kept you awake at night, brought you up short. There must have been some real human stories in there.
Oh, there absolutely were. And what was really interesting from the research was the four participants that we had, and they were self-selected. There was no control over this, but they all somehow managed to represent a range of journeys. So we had the candidate who, the participant, I said it again, we had the participant who had the parents who were big into sport, and his dad had been the rugby coach and he'd only ever known rugby, and he was from South Wales, and his mum watched him every week play, and then he went to an academy, and then he had an injury which forced him to stop playing, which is why he was coming into teaching. But his identity was being a rugby player. His PE teacher was his coach outside of school. And do you mean everything around his whole existence had been sport activity, but very much rugby. And then all the way to another participant who had the most horrendous experiences and talked of, I don't want to sort of challenge confidentiality, but he talked about games that had been created to almost make fun of the weaker players, the weaker pupils in his class, in order to sort of, as he saw it, to mock and to belittle. And that sort of idea that when he'd expressed interest in doing other activities, because he was a very active child to start with, that he was basically told, you're not good enough to be in the team, you shouldn't bother trying. And that was a self-fulfilling prophecy then, because by the time he got into sort of year 7 and 8 of high school, he was done, and he didn't participate in his PE lessons and found every opportunity to get out of them. And as a consequence, he reflected on the amount of weight he'd put on and how inactive he was, and the challenge in his later life, because he was a mature student in his mid-30s, the challenge of him then coming back to trying to sort his life out, as he said, and go to the gym and lose weight, and the ongoing battle that had created, which he directly referenced all the way back to the fact he'd had such negative experiences. Yet, interestingly, from sort of a strength-based perspective of that negative experience, he was sat there going, I want to make sure my PE lessons are the best they can be. While I'm terrified to teach them, I can't have other people have the experiences I have had. Mm. So his sole mission right from the start was to ensure that that experience was only ever positive. So he had quite a mature, unique positivity to that negative experience. And then you had a couple in the middle who had sort of a mid-range, sort of a little bit of running, a little bit of team sports, a little bit of dance, gymnastics experience, really liked being active, were quite confident, but had always been the ones that never got picked and were in the second class and felt they should have been in the first, but their activities weren't valued by the teacher. So because, again, that's another challenge, is you very often get like the runner or the gymnast or the sort of martial arts person who might be competing for their country, but because they don't do team sports, they don't stand out. They end up in the second class, if you want, or certainly aren't in the attention of the teacher, because the teacher's focus is only in that team sports kind of space. So all four were very interesting in a sense of their their makeup and their journeys. But the you're right, some of the stories, and anecdotally, some of the stories that the wider group outside of the research study would talk about of their experiences were just either P was non-existent or it was geared towards the more able. Typically, the shift is from primary to secondary, sadly. A lot of them would say, well, I had P in primary was fun. I just remember it being fun, running around, playing. They can't really, worryingly, they can't really talk about progression and what they learnt. They just remember it being fun. So you could question over there, is busy, happy, good actually learning? But they had a positive experience. And then they get to secondary, and because they don't sit in this sort of more able and talented, sporty kind of space, the perception of sporty, that word in itself has troubling connotations, but that perception.
And it's got to be team. Has to be team. As an avowed non-team player, as listeners can probably work out from what I'm like on these podcasts, that's weird.
I think it comes from history. It is a historical hangover of the fact that our PE curriculum from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s was made up of hockey, netball, football, rugby, tennis, cricket, athletics, rounders, because they are the dominant sports that we play in our country, and our seasons are dictated by when those sports happen. So by default, they just came into the school system. And you might get a little bit of gym in there, some swimming from a safety perspective. For the girls, they might have dance. But I think it's very historically, not necessarily from a deliberate place, it has just been the way it has happened. And interestingly, I haven't seen the most recent one, but Sport Wales have produced data year in, year out. That's when they do the sort of wider what keeps you active in a sort of Welsh communities kind of PE, sport, not PE lessons, but sport and being active. Most of our population outside of sort of adolescence ages are active by the gym, by running, by yoga. The percentage that stay active in team sports is very small compared to what the offer in a school is. And that's always been a challenge. Even if we talk about it being delivered holistically and better, the offer on the table is also another conversation, which wasn't necessarily part of this research, but it's certainly a consideration from a secondary perspective.
So fast forward in time now, you'd gathered all the data. I would imagine in terms of findings, you had this, and I'm assuming now, but I might be wrong, this sort of divide between the things that were really individual to the individual participants in terms of the findings and their journeys and the interface between their own conception of their own physical literacy and the pedagogical decisions that we were making in the classroom, the environment that they were in, all those variables were very different. So I'm interested in that, but I'm also interested in, like, what did you find that was sort of common? Because I guess you were then having to go, okay, so what am I going to do with the next cohort of PGC primary student teachers, and in what order to make sure that whatever environment they go into, they're going to be set up to teach what is now health and wellbeing in a way that is in the spirit of physical literacy and everything that kind of all the positive that goes along with that concept.
Yeah, it's a huge question. I mean, sorry. That's okay. Some of the bigger factors was around confidence. This idea that their perception of who they saw themselves to be as a physical person, and all four of them valued being active. None of them had a negative context in that respect, and actually were motivated to want to have a go. But it was that confidence of knowing what it looked like, that confidence of putting themselves into that sort of quite vulnerable position of being in front of a class and demonstrating and leading, and the subject knowledge as well, that confidence behind, if you don't know what you're trying to teach, it's very hard to then put a good quality lesson together because you're not confident in the subject knowledge itself. So relatively, I'm not saying unsurprising, but the need to know what it looked like, but actually the confidence was huge. Confidence in the teaching of it and confidence in themselves and how they felt. So that the more able as in the participant that was sort of the rugby player participant, he actually talked about the fact that he was very nervous with this idea that because he was athletic and he looked strong and he looked like he is the part, that there would be an assumption he should know everything. And he was really fearful of actually going, but I don't. I know rugby and I know team sports. I'm quite confident in team sports context of what it looks like. He said, but I don't have the subject knowledge in other things. I don't have gym. I don't have dance. So he was worried from that actual perspective of just because I look the part doesn't mean I necessarily know what I'm doing. And then you had the bigger gentleman who was kind of worried about how his physical appearance would be taken because there would be an assumption that he wasn't motivated and he didn't have good health practice because he didn't look the part but was desperately trying to lose weight to be a better health sort of image from himself. He talked about practicing what he preached and modelling that. But that being very explicit with the pupils that he is on a journey and that they can be on the journey with him. So he, again, the maturity of that participant was quite unique. It all came back to confidence and the importance of it almost being a linchpin, I guess, that this moment that when they can switch their confidence to go, okay, I can do this. I know what it looks like. I know the importance of the value of being active. There was never any discrepancy over that sort of bigger value of needing to be active. But actually, if I can put all these things together, I feel it inside me and I can see that change in me. It goes as far as Kit. Like the very unconfident participant was talking about the fact that it was almost like an act. He went and bought PE kit because he didn't have any. And he said, when I put it on, I felt like I was in a role. I started to have to act out somebody else that wasn't me. But as the year went on, I became that person and that it didn't feel so much of an act, to the point by the end of the NQT year, he was saying teaching PE was some of his most enjoyable lessons that he looked forward to because he saw himself as a teacher of PE. And he was starting to understand, because he'd had a range of experiences by then, of what that could look like. And that had challenged the perception of what he thought it was from his experiences. And as soon as he saw it being delivered in a way that wasn't negative, he was like, I can do this. And that change. The two participants in the middle was, again, geared around that positive experience of knowing what it looked like. They had a little bit more sort of range of subject knowledge because they'd experienced a little bit more between them. But one was an individual, she'd run her whole life. She'd just been a runner. She loved to run, never been team sports, never liked competition. So for her, trying to teach and she wanted to avoid competition. But actually we talked about competition being a really important part of life, but it's the message of how you deliver competition. And that was her journey in the fact that it was how she delivered the message that helped her develop her confidence to teach. So confidence itself was probably one of the biggest factors, then supported around by the actual subject knowledge. And once the confidence was there and they were developing their subject knowledge in what it is they were teaching, they were able to make better pedagogical choices about how they were putting their PE lessons together, the different sort of models of practice they might be drawing on to deliver that. That transition of actually also seeing what they were doing in the classroom as good pedagogical practice and actually going, I can bring that pedagogy into the PE space. Because that's also another challenge literature talks hugely about, is that they see PE as something different to all the other lessons they teach. And all of a sudden in PE, we don't need learning objectives, we don't need scaffolding, we don't need modelling, we don't need differentiation because we've given them the ball and they're running around and they're happy and they're active. And that masks as good learning. But that to me is like putting a child in a library who can't read and saying, learn to read. Well, it's the same to me. It's the same analogy. Like you have to learn how to run, to move, to enjoy in a positive experience. And it is more play based in the younger ages, and it becomes more structured. but it's still games and exploration and the teamwork and working together and the communication and all those bigger things that underpin what is, in essence, team sports. When you get into competition, or the drive to just want to be active and have a positive experience to go out for a run at the weekend and things like that.
Yeah, that really resonates with me, because we do have the same problem in drama, in that it can be seen as, you know, having a lot of fun playing and role play. And, you know, it's something that particularly when they're young, they do naturally, but not with an audience in mind. Mm. They're not doing it with a view to communicate meaning to an outside eye.
Yeah.
And so without teaching them about the concept of audience and purpose, and then form, and how to sort of shape what it is that they're trying to communicate and do that through body and voice and space and all of those things, then they could see drama as being really, really fun. But like you said earlier on, that really resonated with me. Go, yeah, I really enjoyed drama. Not really sure what I learned, though.
Yeah.
or just can't remember. Couldn't really tell you what we did, but I know it was fun.
It was fun, yeah.
I was thinking of another side effect of people seeing subjects as different, because I think, again, you know, not to kind of belabor the music PE link, but there is a side effect of when teachers don't feel confident to teach something for whatever reason. And, you know, we know that there will be people out there in primary who are absolutely confident in both of our subjects and very, very happy. But we sort of know there are quite a lot that are not. And that is that they get outside people in to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, they buy them in. Maybe it's less of a problem in your field than mine. I know.
Sadly,
you're
not,
saying
no.
Not. That these people come in and it's done through one-off experiences by often people without qualified teacher status. And yet, you know, we spoke to Gareth Rain down at St. Peter's Primary School a couple of seasons ago, and he was telling us some amazing things about the post-COVID generation coming into reception and the huge problems that are manifesting themselves in the classroom. You know, children who cannot, you know, if a ball is rolled to them, cannot stop that ball with both hands, you know, they're coming into reception. And he had to put in a huge sort of curriculum of daily physical activity. I suppose it's a strong pointer that this stuff, this physical literacy stuff, needs to be done by the teacher that they know they've got that relationship with. It needs to be daily. It needs to be embedded in everything. And yet we sort of know these poor primary teachers have probably had 2 or 3 hours when they've been learning to be teachers. So what does this mean for these primary teachers? What do they need? You say they need confidence. How are they going to get that confidence? What if you could be the sort of fairy godmother for these people? What do they actually need to make sure that they don't farm it out to an unqualified person, and that it does become a daily holistic part of these children's lives?
Oh, gosh. I mean, confidence comes from competence. You can't have one without the other, I believe. So if you do not know what you're teaching or how you're teaching it, it's very hard to then be confident in that moment. So understanding what that curriculum is asking for, or what those developmental child needs are, is critically important to then open that key for that child to then enjoy movement, enjoy being active, and understand what that actually means for them. So what would I do with a magic fairy wand? I mean, I say the status of the subject. I mean, at the time of the research, it was obviously another subject out of about 12 and had very little status. You could argue now with the curriculum reform that health and wellbeing is a more equal share of the pie, but the reality of what is still being taught could be questionable in a sense of the content, because we haven't moved and are not moving yet past sort of a team-based, sports-based teaching to some degree, although a holistic understanding of our mental well-being is much better. The connection of that holistic person and their ability to manipulate and move, I mean, it comes down to writing and small object control, gross fine manipulation from a young child's perspective. And I think our primary teachers can be very good at seeing those things and the needs for those things, but not necessarily seeing the connection into what that could then mean in their physical education lessons holistically. So I think it confidence. They need to see what it looks like in positive experiences. Now, going back to your other point that there are, and I didn't really talk about this because the four of them didn't experience this in the research, but there are issues with outside agencies coming in, or in PE we have non-qualified specialists who might be coaches who get put into schools who are there to teach PE with a coaching hat on. And I've seen very good practice from that, and they become very good teachers because they then come onto the courses. But and I've seen very, very poor practice of that, and does more harm than good. And it's that busy, happy, good coaching model. So it really then comes down to the individual. But we do have that idea of, we do have that worry of the specialist. And like you say, you can't, primary specialist, that's incredible. Like that, what they have to teach is a huge amount of stuff. To be a specialist in every area is really, really hard. But being active and understanding how to move is a lifelong skill, much as I would argue literacy and numeracy are. They are, and they are life skills that are needed. It's more than just playing sport. Understanding how to take care of yourself, sleep, nutrition, wellness, the physicalness of my body. How do I move? How am I active? We're born to move. It's the first thing we do when we're born. We explore our world through movement. Before we acquire language, we explore, as a baby explores everything through movement and touch and grasping and senses. So it's there at the core root of the starting point of your life. It takes different forms as you grow into competitive individual. And as you get older, it becomes more recreational, walking groups and gardening and all those other things are still active physical things. But functional as well, like carrying the shopping, carrying your children, running for a bus, like the fault is older people, often it's the moment where they lose their balance that actually other medical issues come into play. The balance and that ability to be mobile is critical in that sort of maybe 70s, 80s age group. So it's developing that lifelong habit.
I'm interested in something that you said earlier on about what's happened since the Curriculum for Wales landed, and you've now got this health and wellbeing area of learning and experience. And this problem that seems to have arisen of, you know, you seem to have a really clear idea of, you know, what the worries are, what the concerns are around PGC primary teaching, health and wellbeing from a how perspective, from a pedagogy perspective, some all the issues there. And then coupled with that, we've got this issue of the what do I teach, the knowledge bit. And Curriculum for Wales, as you said earlier on, you know, you're still seeing schools that are presenting health and wellbeing as team sports. So I'm treading very carefully here. My question is, does the health and wellbeing AOLE, as it stands, and how to design your curriculum on that front, does it sufficiently support primary schools in designing their own locally relevant curriculum for health and wellbeing? And also coupled with that, so deciding what they're going to teach, but also, do you think there's enough professional learning out there that would, before they even do that, address this issue of who am I, what do I believe about it? Because it strikes me that they're probably going to make some poor choices about what they put in their health and wellbeing curriculum if they haven't done the work of, well, what is it for? And what were my experiences? And how is that informing our choices? Do you think Curriculum for Wales sets them up to be able to do that?
The potential is there. Currently, the professional learning offer of supporting, I think, from a PE perspective, health and wellbeing perspective. And I say that deliberately because health and wellbeing as an AOLE, obviously PE is within that. But I think it's hard to say because I haven't been into many primary schools more recently. I think the delivery of primary, they're very good at the content that is geared around health, diet, nutrition, sleep, mental health, our emotions, our resilience, our relationships, which is a big part of the health and wellbeing AOLE now, because obviously some of the old PSE has been assumed into health and wellbeing.
And is that content that was already there? Was there a sort of...
I mean, there's loads of programs out there in primary school. They use Jigsaw, they use other sort of emotional, social wellbeing based products. So it's... And the wellbeing of their pupils is first and foremost something I think primary schools do very, very well. I think the presence of the physical part in the curriculum orders is very small. And I think that has caused us a lot of issues because it is one or two lines that talks about experiencing a range of physical activity opportunities. It doesn't go into any more detail than that. So actually what schools then do and how they do it is up to their interpretation of that, because there's no one saying they can or can't, how they interpret what that looks like for their pupils. So they have the ability to potentially make some great choices. They have some ability to make some great choices, but they potentially could also make decisions justified by that curriculum that keeps the same practice going. And I don't know if we're connecting very well the practical into the theory. We still see it as here's your PE lesson and here's your health and wellbeing classroom lesson.
And is how there a risk things... of that mind-body, I'm just
absolutely.
Thinking of that Cartesian split that you were referring to at the start.
Absolutely. So if we are doing it well and we're underpinning by the concept of physical literacy, and the concept of physical literacy was used to help write the health and wellbeing AOLE, so it does exist, although it's explicitly not named, its concept, it underpins some of the wording in there. And if you unpick that with professional learning, you could go in that direction of looking at this needs to be interconnected. This, what we're doing in this classroom has to come into the conversation in the practical, and the practical vice versa. And the practical is also about developing the skills and providing a range of positive opportunities and good experiences of team-based, individual-based, creative-based. And I would argue in a primary sense, I'm sure there'll be people who might listen to this who maybe disagree and challenge, and that's always welcome for a healthy conversation. But I would argue, I don't know if we need formalised competitive sports in primary schools. I think that could be built on in secondary. In primary, it might be about teamwork and competition, but that can be done through a range of different activities. I don't think it needs to be that we teach netball or we teach basketball or we teach hockey. It might be those are offered in the older age groups of maybe 4, 5 and 6 extracurricularly, where there's great provision and they can bring it in and they can apply some stuff. But pedagogically, what are we wanting to get out of our PE lessons? So I'm not doing any disrespect to the curriculum, the extracurricular provision. That still needs to be in place, and that's a great opportunity. That's sourced internally by the staff or externally by other providers coming in. But what goes on in that curriculum PE lesson? How are you developing those sort of fundamental movement skills from a competency perspective, but delivered in a way that is holistic and connects in and builds the confidence and the motivation of the pupils is critical. And then obviously from the point of view of the research is how do you get your student teachers to the position where they value and can do those connections. Now, I think our student teachers coming in now are more holistic in the way they see things. That they're almost a step in the right direction there. Mm. It is the experience of the competence and the teaching of the skills that is often where they will still struggle. So the priority from a teacher training perspective is to still provide an element of those skills in the small hours that we have, but bringing in that wider conversation around identity and the physical literacy concept, but then teacher identity. There's another theory in the research that I've drawn on, which is occupational socialization theory, which says as a teacher is socialized, the socialization of a teacher into the profession, it argues happens in three stages. You have the anticipatory stage, where it's everything that's happened up until the point they start the PGC sort of training. You then have the stage, which is the 1 or 2 year teacher training program, which arguably has very little effect to some degree. And then you have the third phase, which is everything that, that comes professionally afterwards in their professional phase. So what we do in that PGC year is critical. And then from a physical education perspective, drawing on physical literacy and underpinning the why we're doing what we're doing, challenging that identity. Because what occupational socialization theory tells us is that the pedagogical choices a student teacher will make will be driven by their values and beliefs and experiences. So they will either, they will draw on what they see, they will refer to the experiences they've had and draw back to, or we end up in Tinnings calls a pedagogy of necessity, which is like survival mode. So if they can't do it, they default back to something they know, which could be poor practice. And so you have a couple of things at play there. So challenging, getting them to reflect on everything they are and who they are because of those experiences coming into the course, I think is a really important starting point. And I think that's also important for the teachers in schools, going back to your question about actually what is it that we're asking them to do? What do we do? Who do they see themselves as that teacher when they're in their health and well-being moment that they can sort of, they believe, they embody, they can talk about the why these things are important to then help them make good pedagogical choices about how they might bring in different forms of assessment, how they might differentiate that learning for the range of child that's in the class, which they will happily do in the classroom where they've got different groups running and different learning activities, or what a lot of primary schools have of choice of activities where the kids move from activity to activity across the week and all geared around a theme. And then they go into this isolated PE moment and they're taught as a group of 20 who are all doing exactly the same thing at the same time. Or things like the yoga on the YouTube is put up and the kids are copying, or it's Just Dance is on and the kids are having a dancing session by copying from Just Dance. Like, it's not, they're active and they're having a positive experience, but you've got to argue, what are they learning? How are they developing their love for being active and that physical sense? Because if that's the poor experience they have and they go into secondary school and all of a sudden the secondary school are saying, we're doing all these activities and these sports, no wonder they don't enjoy it and they don't like competition. Because that could be a really well-meaning secondary teacher with a really positive message, but it's not going to be receptively landing with that pupil because of those experiences or lack of experience they've had. So how do we challenge that rhetoric, that conversation with our existing students, because they are that next generation that are coming through? That's kind of really where the research was driving towards, is what can we do in that ITE year, albeit small, but arguably could have impact. There is literature out there that says it can have impact if that provision is really carefully considered. And I would argue part of that consideration, from what we've seen from the PhD, is that getting them to talk and reflect on that previous experience, but the why, and getting them to understand that's part of who they are, and maybe developing or challenging some of those, that philosophy, thank you, and how that can then change the experiences, but keep coming back to that conversation, because as they go through their first placement, that changes. And then they come back and they share those experiences and that changes again. And then they go into their second placement. Do you mean it's not one conversation that happens in September and never return to? It's that constant thread of a conversation around what is your teacher identity? Because we are socializing you into the profession now. So what is your teacher identity? How are those things and factors affecting it? And from the point of view of primary PE, are we developing ourselves as student teachers with that concept at its core, yeah, with our motivation, our confidence, our competence, so that you can model and make positive choices in the pedagogical actions you then choose to take once you are practicing teacher.
And just to let listeners know, there will be a short ceremony after this recording where I bequeath my hat to Emma, the hat of asking mean questions about curriculum for Wales to guests. My job. Good one, though. There's lots and lots of questions there, aren't there, about how we make that work for teachers. Anyway, that will come after this recording, but now I think it's time to let you move on to our homework slot, something interesting and something to try.
Yeah.
You can choose. Which one would you like to do first?
Why don't we do something interesting? I had to wrap my brains because it's not a lot that happens in my life outside of two small children and work. But I've been, it comes, I guess it's a little bit educationally, it's a little bit child development-y, and it just fascinates me how children learn. And I know I'm secondary trained, I've done my PhD in my primary, and I have two small children at home. So they're kind of, all those three things are colliding together. And there is this child psychologist called Dr. Becky, who I have been following recently, and she talks really interestingly more recently. Well, actually, I've found it more recently. I think it's probably not recent in a sense of its publication, is this idea of the learning space and how do we get from this idea of not knowing something to knowing something and what goes on in the learning space between those two moments of not knowing and knowing, whatever you want to interpret that as, a child development, toddler, adult, child in secondary school. And she talks about this idea of the resilience a child needs to get from the not knowing to the knowing, and how long a child can stay in that learning space is actually where the resilience is built, not the ability to get to the knowing part. It's how long they can cope in the messy resilience of between not knowing and knowing and working out what that answer is, and how we foster that in an educational setting. So that's just something that's caught my eye recently that I'm just exploring a little bit more.
And you've got something for listeners to try that you've been talking about a lot at home, I hear.
Yeah, well, golf is really big in our house recently. And there's a with a PE hat on and a sort of well-being hat on, and the idea that once you hit a certain age, some of the activities you've done for years aren't necessarily accessible to you anymore or can cause you pain. And actually, and that is the idea of my physical literacy journey, that actually, what the way I used to be active is not the way I can be active now. I have less time, I have small children, I can't just go and run around a basketball court anymore. I mean, I probably could, but I need an oxygen tank on the side. And actually, where is the value? I still value being active. And we've been just exploring more options. And there's a really big drive in new to golf at the moment, with regards to Golf Wales. And there's a huge amount, particularly from a female perspective, of getting women into golf and the money. There's new to golf for men and women, but there's a big drive in just new to golf for women, and money that's coming into golf clubs around Wales to sort of expose people to the game and make it seem much more accessible and fun and friendly, and obviously the well-being that goes with that. It's the social well-being, meeting new people, as well as sort of the physical activity of moving your body. And actually, the physical mechanics of golf is really challenging, but it requires a lot of your body parts you would need in later life with regards to flexibility and strength and the stamina to walk and pull golf carts around big golf courses and things like that. So from a health perspective, I think it's great. From a socialisation perspective, I think it's great. And it's just sort of go try golf, because it's going down really well in our house at the moment.
You have your PE hat and your well-being hat on, but not, I note, your red MAGA baseball cap. You're trying to rehabilitate the image of golf.
I am. I leave that to my wife.
Dr. Fiona Heath-Diffie, thank you very much.
Yeah,
exactly. You will say it, doctor. Thank you very much for joining us in this podcast episode. And thank you to our listeners. We'll be back with you in 2 weeks' time.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Thanks to our colleague from here at Cardiff Met, Dr. Fiona Heath-Diffie, for coming and joining us in the studio today to share her research. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support from Peter Lamben and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We're on social media at Talk Teaching Pod if you want to come and say hello. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.